Masechet Bava Mesia Daf Lamed He. Yesterday we saw a law of Rav Huna that if a shomer is watching an item and gets lost or stolen and he pays for the item, even though he's paying for the item, he also has to make a vow that it's not in his possession, because we suspect that maybe the shomer will say, oh, look at this nice cow, you know what, I'd like to keep it, so you know what, I'll just pay for it. And it's kind of like he feels like he's buying it. And maybe he'll justify that he's not stealing because he's paying for it. But the truth is that the owner would really want it back. And maybe if he wants to sell it, okay, they can say, yeah, can I buy it? Do you mind that if I do that? But the shomer here is using the laws of shomer, claiming it was lost or stolen, but it wasn't really lost or stolen. But he's just going to pay for it and keep the item, which is not allowed. So therefore, he has to make a vow that it is not in his possession. That's what Rav Huna said. We challenged Rav Huna from this long Mishnah. The Mishnah ends and says, in the case of Modeh b'miksat, if a shomer, a borrower rather, admits to part of the payment, but not all of the payment, right? This was a case where he borrowed one selah, but he gave a deposit. And the lender said the deposit was only worth half the amount, and the borrower says it was worth three quarters of the amount. So I don't owe you a half, but I do owe you a quarter. He's modeh b'miksat. So normally modeh b'miksat has to make a vow, but here the Mishnah says who should make the vow? Normally it will be the loveh. Instead, it's going to be the malveh. Why? Because we're afraid if the loveh will make a vow, then the malveh will suddenly produce the deposit and show the loveh to be a liar. And we don't want to create such a situation. And therefore, you know what? The malveh, you make a vow for what it's worth, and that it's only worth a half and not three quarters, and this is how much he owes. And the loveh will not, instead of the loveh making that modeh b'miksat vow, it should be the malveh, because the item would be in his possession. Okay, now now that we established that, we asked the question, Ve'im ita l'derav huna kevan de mishtaba malveh sheno b'rishuto hechi matzi mapik aleh. And here's the question. If you agree with the law of Rav Huna that whoever is supposed to have this item, in this case the malveh, who is supposed to have this deposit, has to make a vow that he doesn't have it. We want to make sure he's not pocketing it, just keeping it for himself. So once the malveh makes a vow that he doesn't have it, then we don't have to worry anymore that he's going to produce it. He's not going to make a vow he doesn't have it and then say, oh, actually, I do have it, and lie about that. And therefore, the worry of the Mishnah is unwarranted. We don't have to worry that the loveh will make a vow and then the malveh will produce it and show him to be a liar. And therefore, you have to switch and make the malveh take the modeh b'miksat vow. We don't have to worry about that because the malveh is already making a vow, according to Rav Huna, that it's not in his possession. So why does the Mishnah then switch the vow from the loveh to the malveh? Let the loveh make his regular vow. We're going to have a few answers to this. Here's the first one. We have witnesses that say they saw the collateral item getting burnt. No, so therefore it's no longer in existence. And that's why Rav Huna would agree. In that case, the malveh does not have to take a vow, because there's already witnesses that it's not around. Why is she shouldn't have to make a vow that it's not in his possession? But we challenge that. If in fact it was burned, then how could he ever produce it? So again, there's no reason to suspect, as the Mishnah does, that the loveh will make a vow and then the malveh will produce it and show him to be a liar. It's not true. It's already burned, so you don't have to worry about that. So second answer, Ela Marav Yosef, Sheyesh Adim Shenigneva. There's witnesses that it was stolen. Not that it was burnt, but stolen. And since there's witnesses that it was stolen, so again, Rav Huna would agree that in that case, the Malveh does not have to make a vow that he doesn't have it, because we know it was stolen. We ask about that too. Sof Sof Mehecha Maitila. If it was stolen, then, well, how is he going to produce it? So why does the Mishnah have to worry that maybe the Loveh will make a vow and the Malveh will produce it? We know for a fact that it was stolen from the witnesses. And as it says, the Tarachu Maitila. Could be that, in fact, it was stolen, but it exists somewhere. And so, therefore, maybe the Malveh will go and do extra work. He'll hire some private investigators. He'll track down the thieves and he'll get the item back. And then they'll say, oh, look, see, actually, I got it back. And you see, it was worth a different amount than you said, Love. And that's why we still do have to worry. So we're talking about a case like this, where the Maver does not have to make a vow that he doesn't have it in his possession. And we trust that the witnesses that, in fact, it was stolen, but still he could get it back. And therefore, the Maver should be the one to take the vow. Wait, shouldn't we then worry the other way around? If it's the Malveh that's going to make a vow, this is how much it was worth, then the Loveh might go hire private investigators, track it down, and find it, and show the Malveh to be a liar. And we don't want that situation. We answer, Bishlama Malveh Yada Man Ka Ayil Nafek Bebete, Ve'azil Ve'tarachu Maitila, Ela Loveh Mi Yada Man Ayil Ve'nafek Bebete De Malveh. There's a difference. It makes sense for the Malveh. Malveh knows who came into his house and left his house, and so he'll know, he'll have some idea who stole it. He'll know this certain number of people came. This guy came to visit last week. The other day I had company. The other day I saw someone come in, and so he'll be able to tell the private investigators, right, here's the likely suspects, and he'll be able to go find it. But the Loveh, does he know who went in and who came out of the Malveh's house? So there's no way that the Loveh is going to be able to track it down, and therefore we only worry about the Malveh tracking it down. Another explanation of the Mishnah that will resolve this problem. Abaye explains that Rav Huna is correct, and the Malveh has to make a vow that he does not have it in his possession in all cases, not only in these special cases that we said above, because we're worried that even though the Malveh makes a vow that he doesn't have it anymore, if we then tell the borrower, okay, you make the Modeh B'Miksat vow, there's a gezerah, maybe the Malveh will then come afterwards and say, oh, now I found it. In other words, at the time that I made the vow, yeah, I didn't have it in my possession. And then he waits till the Loveh makes a vow for the amount. And then he says, oh, actually, I just found it. And here you see, it's a different amount than you said. And he will show him to be a liar. So that is a gezerah we have to worry about all the time. And therefore, that's why, even though Rav Huna is right and the Loveh already made a vow that he doesn't have his possession, nevertheless, we worry that he might find it. And therefore, we take the Modeh B'Miksat vow and switch it from the borrower to the lender. Rav Asher amar, Zenishba v'Zenishba, Zenishba shena b'reshuto v'Zenishba kama haya shaveh. Rav Asher says, you misunderstood the Mishnah all along. It doesn't mean that we take the Modeh B'Miksat vow and we switch it to the Malveh. No. In fact, both the Malveh and the Loveh make their own vows. The Malveh makes a vow that he does not have it in his possession, as Rav Huna taught. And the Loveh makes a vow how much the item was worth. That's the regular Modeh B'Miksat vow. So what is the Mishnah teaching? V'chika amar, mi nishba techila, Malveh nishba techila shema ya ishava zeh v'yosi hala et hapikadon. The Mishnah was just teaching who makes a vow first. Not that we switch all the vows to the Malveh. No, it's just that the Malveh makes his vow first and says, I don't have it in my possession. And only then we tell the Loveh, okay, now you make a vow for how much it was worth. Because if the Loveh would make the vow first about how much it was worth before the Malveh says it's not in his position, then we worry that the Malveh will actually produce the item, says, actually, I have it. And see, it contradicts what you said. And turns out the Loveh is a liar, and that Loveh will be considered a liar in the future too. And we want to avoid that possibility. So Rav Asher explains how Rav Huna's law is actually perfectly consistent and is even assumed by the Mishnah. Rav Huna bar tachlifa mishmet Rav Amar. Resha de sefat yubta le Rav Huna. So now a new challenge against Rav Huna. This is from the Resha de sefa, meaning the third case. The third case is where sela hilvitani alav shetai maya shaveh. V'ala omer lo ki ela sela hilviticha alav sela haya shaveh. Patur. The Loveh says, you loan me a sela, and the collateral is worth two, right? I gave you two to hold on, so therefore you owe me one. And the Malveh says, I agree, it was a sela that I gave you, but I think that the collateral was one selah also. So we're totally even. Now, and in that case, that would be the, there's no vow. Because he denies the entire amount. Now, v'imita l'ravuna migo d'mishtaba malveh she'no n'abirshuto l'ishtaba nama gilgul shivua kama haya shaveh. The Mishnah said there's no requirement of a vow or any payment in that case, because he's the malveh is denying the whole thing. However, if you agree with Ravuna, so then Ravuna said the malveh has to make a vow no matter what, that it's not in his possession, right? Because he has to, otherwise, you know, where is it? Bring it out. Let's see what it was. No, he's claiming that it's not in his possession anymore, it's gone, and he claims it was worth one selah. So according to Rav Huna, if you're claiming it was gone, you were supposed to hold on to it. The malveh who holds on to a deposit is, this, in fact, a shomer. So he's going to have to make a vow that's not in his possession, and we have a law of migo. Once someone is making a vow for one thing, we can add on other vows. While you're at it, vow, you know what? Make a vow also about the amount that it was, which is kind of like a modeh b'miksat type of vow. So how come the Mishnah says, if Rav Huna is right that the malveh is making a vow anyway, that's not his possession, then why shouldn't he have to make a while you're at it vow about the amount that it's worth? And so he should have to make a vow, unlike the Mishnah that says no vow. Amar Rav Asher, amrita lishmata kameh derav kahana. V'amar li tehe b'ma'amino. So Rav Asher says, I asked this question to Rav Kahana, and Rav Kahana says it could be a case where the loveh believes the malveh, right? I believe you that you don't have it, and therefore you don't have to make a Rav Huna vow. Rav Huna says, yeah, you have to make a vow to say that you don't have it in your possession. But if the loveh agrees, yeah, I believe you, so you don't have to make this vow. And that's why, since he's not making a Rav Huna vow, there's no while you're at it vow either. We ask, okay, if the loveh is believing the malveh, that the malveh really lost the item, then why shouldn't he believe him also regarding the value of the item, that it was only worth one selah and not two? And the answer is, lakim lebegaveh. The malveh is not certain about it. It was not, doesn't belong to him. And so he knows, you know, he took the item and he put it in the drawer, and so he knows for sure he lost it, because he looks around for it and it's not there, but he's not an expert in how much it was worth. And therefore, the loveh does not believe the malveh. It's not that the malveh is not trustworthy, but the loveh doesn't think that he really knows himself. So how about the malveh? Shouldn't he believe the loveh? Because the loveh would know about it. It belongs to him, and so he probably knows, in fact, how much it's worth. So how come the malveh doesn't believe him? No, the malveh doesn't believe the loveh. So the malveh has no trust in the loveh, just doesn't trust him at all. The loveh does trust the malveh, and generally, to the extent that if he says he lost it, then he really lost it. But he doesn't think that the malveh knows how much it really was. So it's not that the malveh is lying, he just doesn't know, and so he wants him to bring proof. Now, what's the difference? Why would, it's not just about these particular personalities, that this one, you know, I trust this guy, I don't trust that guy, but it's more of a general statement that a loveh would trust the malveh in these types of situations, and the malveh would not trust a loveh in these types of situations. The answer is because loveh mekayem be b'malveh tumat yeshadim tanchem. Malveh mekayem be b'loveh v'selef bogedim yeshadem. Quoting two halves of a pasuk, the full pasuk is, the integrity of the upright shall guide them, the perverseness of the faithless shall destroy them. And the Mishnah, the pasuk, or the midrash on the pasuk, is assuming that if someone is rich, that means that Hashem gave him blessing because he's honest. If someone's poor, then they became poor as a punishment because they were dishonest. And so the loveh, he applies the first half of the pasuk to the malveh. He's wealthy, it must be because yesharim, he is an honest person, and therefore he's blessed with a lot of money, so I would trust him. The malveh does not trust the loveh because he is destroyed. His wealth is destroyed. It must be because he's boged, because he has less. He's not faithful. He is not honest. All right, we can try to do a survey to see if this is true nowadays. Is it true that rich people are more honest than poor people? I'm not sure. Hu gavra de'afkid kefi gabe chavre amale havli kefe. So a certain man has some jewels. He owns them. He deposited them with a shomer. And then it comes time, he wants the jewels back. He has a party. He wants to wear the jewels. So he says, can I have them back? Amar le, le'adane hecha'ot bin hu. So shomer says, I don't know where I put them. It happens a lot. You hide something in a special hiding spot so that no one will find it, but then you forget where that hiding spot is yourself. You put it in a pocket, you put it in a bookshelf, but he doesn't remember where it was. Atale kemed Rav Nachman, amar le kol la'yadana, peshi'ota hi zir shalem. So they came to Rav Nachman to be the judge, and Rav Nachman says, if you don't remember where you put it, that's negligent. What kind of shomer are you? Right, I understand. If you said, I put it in a specific spot, I knew where it was, and now it's gone, it was stolen, fine. But you know you put it somewhere, but you don't remember where you put it? That's just a negligent shomer. Therefore, shomer, you have to pay him for the value of the jewels. It's $10,000. Go pay him $10,000. La shilem azal Rav Nachman lagbe de'apadne mine. Now, the shomer did not pay. So Rav Nachman went to repossess the shomer's palace, and he'll sell it and then give the money over to the owner of the jewels. L'shah l'sof ishtakach kefeh v'iyakur. So he did that. They repossessed the land, but after that, the jewels turns out were found. In the meantime, the price of the jewels went up. It went up to $15,000. So now the question is, can the shomer keep the jewels? Because you took my house and you sold it for $10,000, and you gave it to the owner of the jewels. Okay, now the owner of the jewels is whole. He got paid for what was lost. And now, doesn't that mean that the shomer acquired the jewels that are now found, and now they're worth $15,000? So maybe he can keep them. Amar Rav Nachman, hadriki pi lemarayu v'adra apadna lemarah. Rav Nachman says, not so fast. You cannot do that. Your jewels have to return to the owner, and the palace returns to you, and everything goes back the way it was, and the increased value of the jewels, it will be enjoyed by the original owner of the jewels. Amarava, hava yativna kemed Rav Nachman, ufirkin hamafkid, hava. Ve'amari le, shilem ve'lo rasa li shaba, ve'la ahadar li. One time later, Rava says, I was studying before Rav Nachman, and we were learning the perek of hamafkid. And I asked him about this very case, and I said, isn't this the same as a shomer who says, I will pay rather than make a vow, in which case he is granted the ownership rights. And if the thief is found, he gets double. So shouldn't this case be the same? And we should also say that since the owner of the jewels sold his palace and paid the owner of the jewels the $10,000, so now he should have ownership rights over the jewels. And once they're found and they're now worth $15,000, so the shomer should be able to keep them. What's the difference between that case and this case where Rav Nachman says you have to give them back? But Rav Nachman did not answer him. Rav Nachman felt that it was a bad question. The question's belief, but it was beneath him. It was the answer was too obvious. So Rav had to go figure out the answer himself. And later on, he says, "V'shapir avad lahadar li." Rav Nachman was right for not answering me because it was a stupid question. My tama hatam la atreche lebedina hachatreche lebedina. In the case of the shomer, the owner of the deposit is happy that he doesn't have to go to Bet Din, right? He gave him a cow. The owner of the cow gave it to the shomer, and then he doesn't have it. The shomer could get out of it by saying it was lost and stolen and make a vow. He says, you know what? I'd just rather pay you. I don't want to make a vow. And so the owner of the cow is happy that he doesn't have to bother going to court. And so he's willing to hand over the rights of ownership, including the right to collect double should the thief be found. But in this case, the owner of the jewels, he had to go to court. The other guy said, I'm not paying you anything. They had to go to Rav Nachman, had to go to court, they had to argue, then he still didn't pay, then they had to repossess his stuff. So because the shomer, in this case, gave such a bother and inconvenience to the owner of the jewels, the owner did not hand over ownership rights to the jewels. He said they're still mine, right? And therefore, once they're found, they do have to be returned. So there is an important difference between the two. Lememra dera savadam nachman de shuma hadad. Now, is this to say that according to Rav Nachma, we say an appraisal of an article is returned? In general, if you repossess someone's property because they owe some money, and then it turns out that, oh, they have the money and they want to get their house back, right? So does a person have a right to get his house back if he comes up with the money? He owed, whatever, $10,000. He didn't pay, his house was repossessed, he comes up with the money, can he get his house back? So does this mean, according to Rav Nachman, that Rav Nachman thinks in general that Shuma Hadar? And we say not necessarily, because in this case with the jewels, the appraisal and the repossession was actually a mistake, because the jewels were actually there all along. He just couldn't find them, but now he found them, but he actually had them the whole time, and therefore, once they're found, so he just gives the jewels, and so that appraisal and repossession was done in error, so that goes back. But in a different case where it was not done in error, where the guy really didn't have money and he owed money and his house is repossessed, then maybe he cannot get it back. We cannot tell from this case. And here's the general law regarding Shuma Hadar. We've seen this once before. In the Hardah, they said, you have 12 months. If your house is repossessed because you owed money, you have 12 months to come up with the money and get it back. After that, the house is gone. Amema says, I'm from the Hardah, but I don't agree with what you just said, because I think that the owner of the house can get it back forever. There's no time limit. And the halacha is that a person who gets his house repossessed has the right to get it back forever. Not because that's the letter of the law, but rather because the Torah says you should do what is right and good and go beyond the letter of the law. The person, original owner of a house, has an attachment to his house. It's valuable to him. He feels bad that it was repossessed. And therefore, whoever gets the house should be willing to give it back once the owner, the original owner, comes up with the money to pay his original debt. Now that we learned the law that when someone's property gets repossessed and given over to a creditor, then he can always pay and get it back within a certain time period, or maybe forever, according to Vasita Yashav Atov. So then now we're going to see some interesting applications of this law. Pishita. Shamula lebal chov azal ihu veshamah lebal chov dide amrinan le la adif at migabra datit mine. If someone they collect the property of a debtor, and so it goes to the creditor, he repossesses the guy's house, and now that creditor himself owes money to someone else, and so he takes that same property and gives it to that second creditor. Now, eventually, the original debtor comes up with the money and he wants to get it back. He can go back to his creditor's creditor and say, here, I am paying and I want my property back. Because, he says, you are not any stronger than the person that you got it from. Just like I can repossess it from my immediate creditor, I also can repossess it from you, my creditor's creditor. That's a simple case. But what if here's a more complicated case? Zabena orta vihaba bematana vaday hane mikara data de ara nehut velava data de zuze nehut. If the creditor, the first creditor, repossessed this property of the debtor, and then that creditor, he didn't use it to pay a debt as in the first case, but rather he sold it, or he bequeathed it, or he gave it as a gift to someone else. Certainly, in that case, his intention to begin with was that he wants to give the land, and the people that are going to get it are going to go and use the land, not just for the money. And therefore, when the original debtor comes up with the money, he cannot get his land back. The difference is that in the first case, the creditor is just using it as cash instead of cash. Listen, yeah, I'll just pay you this house, but the creditor's creditor doesn't care about the land itself. He'd actually rather get money. Whereas in the second set of cases, he's gifting or selling the land itself. So the buyer or the receiver actually wants the land and is planning to live there, and therefore the original debtor cannot get it back. Next case, Shamu la le'isha ve'in siba, o shamu mina de'isha ve'in siba umeta, ba'al b'nichse ishto lokeach ave, la mihadad ve'la mehadirinan le. If you have a single woman, and someone owed her money, and they didn't pay, so she repossessed someone's land, and then she got married. Or the other way around, she had property, but she owed someone money and didn't pay, and her land was repossessed. And then she got married, and then she died. Now, generally, a husband inherits his wife's property, including property that she brings into the marriage. However, his status, the way he inherits it, is like a buyer. That says he has the status of a buyer. And therefore, in the first case where her land, she got land from someone else. So the original guy who owned that land, he, while she's around, he can pay and get the land back. However, once the husband comes around, once she gets married, so now the husband is like a buyer. And therefore, as we just said, the original debtor cannot reclaim his land from a buyer. And therefore, he cannot get his land back. And similarly, in the second case where she had land and it got repossessed. So now if she wants to, she can come up with the money and get her land back as long as she is alive. However, once she dies, now the husband is not in her place. The husband is just like a buyer, and a buyer does not have a right to go and pay that debt and say, "Oh, I want it back." Right? He does not have a right to it. So, while she's alive, it works, but not after. While she's alive, she can repossess it, but not after she dies. Now, how do you know in general that a husband is like a buyer? Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina reports that in Usha they made a takana that if a woman brings property into the marriage, and she sells it, and these are nichse melog, that the husband is allowed to enjoy during the time of the marriage, and she decides to sell it during the marriage, and then she dies, the husband has a right to go after those buyers, and he can claim to be as if he's a first buyer, even though he didn't actually buy it. Just by marrying her, he takes acquisition of that land, and so he can go and take it from them as the first buyer. Anyway, the consequences of him being a buyer is that if this land was originally belonged to someone else, that the wife repossessed, they cannot get it back from the husband because he is like a buyer. Now, in a case where, let's say I owe you money and I can't pay, and I say, you know what, I don't want to go to Beit Din. I have this property here. Just take it. I take this property and in as settlement for your loan. And now I come up with the money, and I want to get it back. So there's two opinions, one between Rav Acha and Rav Inah. One says, I can get it back, like the same as a repossession. And the other says, no, I cannot get it back. What's the reasoning? The one says, I cannot get it back, will say, well, this was a proper, normal sale. A normal sale, you can't just go back on the sale. So I changed my mind. Because I didn't go to court. If a court repossesses someone's land, the court forced it and took my land. Wait, I have a right to take it back. But here, I didn't go to court. I agreed to say, you know what? Here, take the land. And therefore, I cannot get it back. Whereas the other opinion that says that I can get it back will say, this is not a regular full-fledged sale. The only reason that I let you have it and then didn't go to Beit Din was only because I was embarrassed to go to Beit Din. Then it becomes a whole public matter. It's such a pain. I wanted to save myself the trouble and the shame. And therefore I said, okay, just take it. But I didn't really want to give up the land. And once I come up with the money, So just like I can get it back if it was repossessed by a court, this is the same thing. I should be able to get it back. Now, in general, if I repossess someone's land, when can I start garnering the produce from that land? Do I have to wait till it's till it's actually and in my possession? So it's three opinions. Rabba Amar Miki Matya Ad Rachta Lide. Rabba says as soon as the court authorization document comes to my hand. Well, as we go through the process, the court eventually will write a document that says you have a right to go repossess that person's land. As soon as I get the document, already whatever produce comes in will be mine, even though I haven't physically gotten it yet. Abaye says even earlier, even from the time that the witnesses sign that authorization of possession, it's already mine. Even before it gets to my hands, right in court, they already processed it, and someone tells me, oh, they processed it in court. Even before it gets delivered into my hands, it's already official. Rava Amar Miki Shelimu Yeme Achraz Ta. Rava says actually has to be later. Because even after they write the document of authorizing repossession, then there's a whole proclamation time period where the Beit Din says, listen, this land is going to be auctioned off and it goes to the highest bidder. Now, if it happens to be that I'm the highest bidder as the creditor, then I will be able to have the produce for that whole time. But it could be that I won't be the highest bidder. Maybe someone else will get it, in which case I cannot get the produce. And therefore, it's not until the proclamation concludes, the public auction concludes, and then I know it's mine, only from that point on can I take the produce. Next Mishnah. Hasocher pada mechaverov ishilah leacher umeta kedarka. Yishama socher shemeta kedarka, vashoel yishalem lasocher. We're going to be introducing some, a little bit complicated, but some very interesting cases with some surprising consequences. So one person, socher, he rents a cow from the original owner of the cow. And then that renter lends it out for free to a third person. The third person is a shoel. Okay, and it dies in a normal way. Dying in a normal way, the socher is patur. He has to make a vow that it died in a normal way, that would not be out of negligence. And then the socher does not have to pay the original owner. But now the socher, he turns to the shoel and says, shoel, you borrowed it, right, without paying. A shoel is liable for the animal dying even in its normal way, unless it's in the course of working. So here it was not in the course of working. So the shoel pays the socher, and the socher keeps the money. Socher only has to make a vow that it died in a normal way, and the original owner is out that all of that money. Very interesting case. Amar Rabbi Yose, Kesad Hala Ose Sechora Beparato Shel Chavero, Ela Tachzor Lepara LaBe'alim. Rabbi Yose disagrees. He says, how could the socher make money, get a business profit from the cow of someone else? It's the original owner, right? Owns the cow, loses out, and the socher is able to make a profit off of someone else's cow? That doesn't make sense. Rather, the cow, or it's dead now, the value of the cow should go back to the original owner. So therefore, the shoel should have to pay, but that money will go to the original owner. Okay, they both have good points. Amar le Rav Idi bar Avin la Abaye, mechdi socher b'may kani lehai para b'shvua. Now we're going to ask a question on the Tanakama. This socher, and how does he acquire the cow from the original owner? Is it not with an oath? By taking an oath and saying that, listen, it died of natural causes, I was not negligent. But once he makes that oath, so now he acquires the cow from the original owner. If so, v'nema le maskir la socher, dal ant v'dal shibu'atach, v'anda mishta'en adina behadeh shoel. The original owner, the maskil, should be able to tell the socher, you know what, remove yourself and remove your oath. I don't want to deal with you at all. I'm going to litigate with the shoel instead. Now, since the original owner is still the original owner, because the socher does not acquire the cow until he makes a shivua, so the original owner says, forget the shivua. You just leave. I am going to litigate the shoel directly. and therefore he'll be able to take the money himself. He'll tell the Shoel, you're a Shoel, this is my cow, it died of natural causes, you have to pay me. Amar le mi sevarat shochel bishvua hu de kanila mishat mitahu de kanila ushvue kedei lafis dato shel baal habayit. So that was the question. According to the question, then makes it should be that the socher cannot make money and keep the value. Rather, it should go to the original owner, which was the opinion of Rabbi Yose. There's a challenge to Tanakama, and Tanakama can answer. Abaya answers for Tanakama. No, do you think that the socher acquires the animal when he makes a vow? Not true. He actually acquires the animal as soon as it dies. The moment it dies, dies of natural causes. Socher is not at fault. The socher does not have to pay, and the socher thereby acquires the ownership rights of that cow. And ownership rights will be that since he lent it to someone else, so he can acquire that money. And the shivuah is not there to make an acquisition, but rather to alleviate the concern of the original owner, that the original owner in general will think to himself, wait, did it really die of natural causes? Maybe it was of negligence. And so to calm his mind, the socher should make a vow. But really, the socher already acquires the rights to it as soon as it dies. And therefore, the original owner, sorry, you lost out. The socher is now the owner, and the socher then has a right to litigate the shoel. Amar Rabbi Zera, Pamim sha'be'alim mishalimim kama parot la socher. Rabbi Zera now has a fantastic theoretical case where the original owner will have to pay many cows to the socher. I mean, this is very unusual. We can understand a case where the socher has to pay one cow to the original owner if the socher was negligent and he has to give a cow. We could also understand the case of one cow the other way around. If the cow dies of natural causes, the socher said, listen, I rented a cow from you for 100 days. It dies after 80 days. So there's 20 days left to this rental period. You have to give me another cow for the rest of the time. And that we can understand also, right? That would be an easy case. But Rabbi Zera says, I can concoct a case where the owner will have to give, we're going to see here, four cows for the one single cow that he originally gave him. How so? Hechidame. Agra mine mea yome, vadar shayla mine tishrin yome, vadar agra mine temanan yome, vadar shayla mine shibrin yome, umeta betoch yime she'elata, da'akol she'ela u'she'ela mechayeb hada para. The original owner rented out his cow for 100 days to the renter. And then the renter, in turn, just like we saw before, the renter could lend it to someone else. Here, he lends it back to the original owner, but as a shoel, without payment. And so now, the shoel will have it for that 90 days, the shoel original owner. Now, the shoel original owner then agrees to rent it out to that same socher for 80 days. And then, the socher lends it back to the original owner for 70 days. So altogether, the socher has rented it twice, and the original owner has shoel, has borrowed it twice. Now, if it should die within that 70 days, where all of the deals overlap, so now the shoel will have to pay for each and every she'ela instance, and that's two of them. So the original owner, who's also the shoel twice, oh, it died, even of natural causes, you have to pay, and you borrowed it twice. So the original owner has to give two animals to the socher, and those the socher will keep. In addition, since the socher borrowed two animals and they died in the middle of the time period, he says, listen, you rented to me twice, and I paid you for that, so you have to give me a replacement animal for me to use for the duration of the period. And so therefore, another two animals, the original owner will have to give to the socher that he will get back at the end of the whatever time period is relevant. But right then, the original owner has to give four cows, all to the socher, all in replacement of the one cow that he originally gave him. Fantastic. אמר לה רב אחא מדפתי לרבינה מחדי חדה פרהי אילה אפקה אפקה מסחירות אילה לשאלה אפקה משאלה אילה ואילה לסחירות רב אחא מדפתי tells רבינה I don't agree with this law of Rabbi Zera because it's only one cow. How could you have to pay many times for one cow? Rather, it only makes sense that once he gives one legal status, then it's going to be the other legal status will be removed. So that originally he rents it out, the socher rents it out. Now after that, when the socher lends it to the original owner, so now the socher is sechirut is removed, and now it's a she'ela. And then after that, when the shoel, original owner, rents it out again, he's no longer a shoel. Now the sechirut replaces it. So each deal replaces the one before, and so in the end, there's really only one deal left. That's what Rav Acha says. But Rav Ina defends the original law of Rabbi Zera and says, is the cow intact that he could say such a thing? If the cow was actually intact, then you just undo the deals, right, one by one. The borrower would say, here's the cow, right? And then he gets it back as because he was also the maskir, and then he gives it back and says, here's the cow. So once he gives the cow back, so that's it. He's certainly going to be free of paying anything, but here's the thing, the cow is not around, and therefore he has to pay as a shoel. He has to pay as a shoel again, right? Because they're returning. He doesn't have an item to return. He has to pay, and he has to pay for every single liability. Mor barav Asher amar en lo alehen ela shete farot chada dishela vechada dischirut shum shela achati veshum sechirut achati deshela kane legamre dischirut avad beyoma yome sechirute umihadar le lemara. Mor barav Asher has an in-between opinion, and he says no. The original owner only has to give two cows to the socher, one for the category of she'ela and one for the category of sechirut, because all of the categories of she'ela are one and all of the categories of sechirut are one. He doesn't have to pay for twice for each she'ela and twice for each sechirut to replace the animal, because I rented from you two animals. You didn't rent two animals. You rented one animal. You rented one animal twice for overlapping time periods, but you only rented one animal. And therefore, the original owner has to give one for borrowing, because the original owner borrowed it and it died in his possession. So he has to pay for that. But he borrowed the same animal. He just borrowed the same animal twice for all the overlapping periods. But that's the same. And so therefore, he only has to give one animal to the socher, who will keep it. And the other one, as a socher, he also has to give him an animal that for the duration of the rental period. But then that one, he eventually will go back to the original owner. So in the end, the original owner will be out permanently, only one animal. Baruch Adonai Leolam. Amen v'amen.